This is a shotgun microphone in here, and this black foam is a special sort of rain cover. Not only protects it from the rain, but it protects it from the sound of the impact of rain. The sirens will be interesting.
The chimes of Big Ben as never heard before. That was part of a work entitled Speeds of Time 2008 by the sound artist Bill Fontana, currently installed in the Tate Britain. And we'll have more about that later in the programme. In many ways, acoustica, with its invented instruments and pictorial diagrammatic score, is a precursor to some areas of what is now referred to as sound art. And to end tonight's programme, we move to a work of contemporary sound art, Speeds of Time 2008 by Bill Fontana. The piece is a real-time sculptural sound map involving the chimes of Big Ben and an array of microphones placed at increasing distances from the iconic clock tower. Here and now, caught up with Bill on a rooftop not far from the Palace of Westminster.
So this morning we were at the clock tower at Horse Guards, the roof of the Arts Council of England headquarters. These guys were at BBC Westminster, and we were on the top of the bell tower, Westminster Abbey, and here we are on the roof of the Treasury Building on Parliament Square. You know, we're mapping the sounds of the bells of Big Ben. There's a live microphone up in the Westminster Clock Tower, and live microphones on these different rooftops. And if you think of the speed of sound, at about 1,100 feet per second, and you're listening simultaneously from these vantage points, what you're going to have in this sound sculpture is a real-time multiple sound image of the bells of Big Ben. But besides the bells of Big Ben, other sounds of London, ambiences of London, will sometimes get processed by this matrix, but particularly when the flight path to Heathrow sort of intersects the zone. That's going to be quite interesting. Sirens. At Horse Guards, you're actually going to very clearly hear the Horse Guards clock, which is actually a much older clock than the Westminster chimes. And before Big Ben was built in 1859, it was like the clock of London. So it's very nice to actually have a live duet between the Horse Guards and Big Ben.
We have to remember, don't we, when these clocks were put in place, not many people had chronometers.
That's right.
Carry watches or timepieces.
So the public clock was a very important sort of item in the city. And it was really a primary means for being certain about what time it was. And also, I think Big Ben was created in the Victorian era. And in a way, it has to do also with the regulation of labor, and it's a way of regulating society according to your certainty of time and what time it is. And I guess I'm making a musical piece about what time it isn't.
But you're also bringing in the art of space here, because we hear the bells, we hear these delays, we hear the bell strike and then strike again, so we have multiple strikes. And that's brought about because of the distance of the microphone from the sound source.
Right. It's really a physical fact of the bells. You know, these delays aren't created artificially. It's just that at Westminster Abbey, the sound of Big Ben arrives 0.8 of a second later. And there are different delays from these distances. And normally, nobody would ever imagine thinking that you could kind of hear these together and compare the differences. But given the sort of technology of networks and live transmission systems, it's possible actually to think of almost turning the distances in London into a kind of musical composition.
How does this piece relate to your piece Speeds of Time 2004? Because you've worked in Big Ben before, haven't
you? Right. That was commissioned by the Works of Art Committee of the House of Commons, and it was a musical experiment. It was a temporary project that people would hear in the colonnade adjacent to the new Palace Yard at the base of the bell tower. And what was different about that is it was really looking inward. It really was very much focused on the great clock. It was really a composition in which I took the live sounds of the clock and the bells and programmed a digital mixer to generate 7 acoustic delays in relation to the sources so that everything happened 8 times instead of once, and the sounds were moving in the space. It was asking, in a way, the same questions that I'm asking now, but the difference is that the delays I'm working with are real. You know, they haven't been composed. You know, the City of London is composing them.
It's a physical fact.
It's a physical fact. You know, the first one, you know, I was looking inward and reflecting inward in the Palace of Westminster. And this one, you know, I'm exploring the relationship of Big Ben to London and London's relationship.
It seems like you're working here with the idea of displacement, and it's something that's underpins a lot of your work. You've also worked at the Tate Modern with the Millennium Bridge, where you used sophisticated contact microphones on the bridge and transported, almost like a bridge, the sound of the bridge into the turbine hall in the Tate Modern. So it seems that the idea of moving sound from one place to another, displacing it, is important. Why is displacement so fascinating for you?
Well, I think as a culture, we tend not to listen to the sounds around us. We don't think about them. And many, many years ago, I was interested in, you know, Marcel Duchamp's visual strategy of the found object, where you could take an ordinary object like a urinal or a bicycle wheel and make a work of art out of it. And suddenly it changes your relationship to that, and you start to think about the meaning that this has. And I think it's the same with sounds, when you take them out of their normal context and put them in another situation. But the way you do that, the strategy for doing that, is very important. I don't do it in a random way. The oscillations of the Millennium Bridge, to me, it just seemed like a natural thing to do, to bring it into this industrial space of the turbine hall. And to have it interact with those acoustics. And when people heard that there, a lot of people, because there wasn't a real visual element except the space itself, thought that the building was making the sounds. I always think about what it means to take a sound as a found object and put it in another situation, whether it's harmonizing with that situation, whether it's transforming it. I did a project in Paris in 1994 called Sound Island for the occasion of the 50th anniversary of D-Day, in which I took the live sound of the Normandy beaches with a whole elaborate network of microphones and hydrophones and transmitted it to a sound system embedded on the facades of the Arc de Triomphe, so that the living sound of the sea was this invisible, vivid material that wrapped that monument. It didn't change anything in the way it looked, but you couldn't hear the traffic anymore because it was masked by the natural white noise of the sea. And it caused a lot of people to suddenly engage with, you know, why is this here? What does it mean? What is this?
Let me ask you another fundamental question about this kind of work. Everything you do is in real time. These signals are being transmitted in real time. Why don't you just record them and play them back off CD or 8-channel DVD?
It's too easy. But it's more than that. I feel like philosophically what I'm interested in is the nature of time and the nature of the moment. You know, I've spent 40 years of my life listening and recording sounds and transmitting sounds. And I suppose in my fantasies and daydreams, I think, what is the ultimate reality of this moment? And for me, the ultimate acoustic reality of this moment is if I could hear all the sounds that are happening in London, in the world, in the universe, I imagine, you know, that reality. I can't know it, but I imagine it. It's like trying to understand what a high exponent number would be. You know, how do you understand 90, you know, with many, many zeros on the end of a number? It's kind of incomprehensible. But I guess I'm trying in small ways, right, as an artist, to kind of reach into that sense of the infinity of a moment. And why record it when the moment itself is so perfect and so interesting? You know, we live in a world where most people experience music as recording, and it's more unusual to actually hear the musicians. And to me, the world and the physical reality of the world is making music constantly if you have the ears to find it. So I think my job as an artist is to develop strategies for communicating that in very focused ways and to use my skills as a listener and as a composer to understand how a certain situation generates musical patterns and to make a sculpture that's listening. You know, sculpture is traditionally a physical embodiment of some aspect of the human condition. And the kind of sculptures I'm making are embodying the act of listening.
Now, you've been working in this way for over 30 years. We now use the word sound art. We now talk about sound art. And that's only been commonplace for the last 10 or 15 years. But you've been working a lot longer than that. Mm-hmm. Where do these ideas come from? Are they rooted in any kind of tradition? Is this music? Is it art? Is it fine art? Is it conceptual art?
I think it's all of the above. I was a student in New York in the late 60s. I knew John Cage very well, and he obviously influenced me quite a bit and encouraged me quite a bit. And he was famous for saying that music is continuous and listening is intermittent. And Marcel Duchamp said in his Notes to the Large Glass, musical sculpture, sounds lasting and leaving, forming and sounding, a sculpture that lasts. So if you think of those as two parts of an equation, I put those together and I arrive at sound sculpture, because it's listening that's continuous, not intermittent.
But people tend to think of sound sculptures as objects that make sounds.
Right. Precisely, mine have never been objects. To me, sound is very physical, and it has a real sculptural dimension to it, because if you take any sound that you're hearing, and if you've done any work with recording sound, you realize that there's many choices you have about where you can put a microphone. And if you have the ability to use more than one microphone to listen to a sound, you realize that a sound field is like this three-dimensional thing, kind of alive in a space, much like a person is a three-dimensional thing alive in a space. And from the very beginning, I became really intrigued by kind of sculptural dimensions.
And it moves, it's fluid.
It's fluid.
And where you put the microphones affect what can actually be heard.
Right, of course.
So that's going to inform what we can actually hear when we choose to listen, when we move from those moments of just hearing in the background into those moments where we're really listening.
Right.
So it seems that what you're doing primarily is encouraging us to listen, to use our ears.
Well, to sort of awaken to the fact that you have these magical sensors as part of your body, and that the most interesting music you're ever going to hear is music you can make yourself by using your ears. I came to regard listening as a form of composition, as a form of making music. Thank you.
That was a recording of Speeds of Time 2008, a sound installation by Bill Fontana, which can be experienced at the Tate Britain until the 3rd of October. And there's a live stream of that work on the BBC Radio 4 website. And that brings us to the end of tonight's programme. Our email address is here.and.now@bbc.co.uk. And there's more information about this programme at the Here and Now page on the Radio 3 website.